Get ready for the greatest roast of all time. The Roast of Tom Brady. A Netflix live event happening May 5th. Hosted by Kevin Hart. The seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady. Live only on Netflix.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Welcome to Real Jam Radio. I'm Daniel Rue, your host, and so happy to have you with us for this episode. This is a two-guest version of Real Jam Radio. The first segment is with Jared Weiss of The Athletic, going in-depth on the Celtics, talking about their phenomenal regular season, how the playoffs could shake out for them, and the Drew Holiday extension, among other topics. So that conversation runs about a half an hour. And then I have Keith Smith of SpotTrack on to talk about the close to the season, to some of the dynamics that we're going to be looking at for the 24 and 25 off seasons, including a potential cap increase with the new TV deal. And we end up talking about the Drew Holiday extension too. So you get that from two different perspectives, which was a lot of fun. And with Keith, we go well over an hour. So there's a lot of content here. I hope you really enjoy it. Brought to you by Factor Meals. FactorMeals.com/RealGM50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box, which is pretty fantastic. And then Prize Picks. You can download the Prize Picks app and use the code CLNS to get a deposit match up to $100, which is fantastic. So the combined episode is on the longer side. I hope you really enjoy it, and I had a lot of fun recording it. Thank you so much for coming on.
Hey.
A lot to discuss on the Boston front, but I think the place I want to start is just, how would you summarize the season as somebody who's followed the team as closely? I mean, I've usually used the shorthand of best team in the league, most talented team in the league, but what more is there to that part of the story?
There's honestly not that much more to it. I mean, they are... The Celtics' greatness comes from their consistency and versatility. And honestly, I think that's a bit of a step forward compared to the last few years. They just, by adding on Kristaps Porzingis, you know, and forget about the development of Derek White, which has been a huge revelation and has probably been a big part of why they're able to get to the like absurd level that they've been at in the regular season, as opposed to like just being the best team in the league by a decent margin. But Porzingis stepping in and just giving their offense a consistent safety valve whenever they need it has just been the big missing piece thing that they've been looking for years. You know, Brown and Tatum, they were carrying the offense pretty much on their backs for the entirety of the last few years. And Marcus Smart was the one that was trying to hold that all together. And obviously Marcus has his limitations on the offensive end. And so now they don't have anybody with any limitations. It's kind of crazy when you look at this year's team from an offensive standpoint compared to the last few years. Every single person in their starting lineup can do every single thing on the floor. Besides, Porzingis can't initiate pick and roll. That's like the only thing that is out of the box. But like the rest of those guys, Holiday, White, Brown, Tatum, they all can run pick and roll. They all can post up. They all can spot up. They can do it all. And so the Celtics have just been un-game planable so far the regular season. And what makes them so interesting is, so, you know, statistically, the record, they've been like a mile past the rest of the league essentially this year. And in the playoffs, it's going to be really interesting to see if their versatility doesn't provide them such a substantial advantage anymore, because I think what happens for a lot of teams is they fly into Boston, they have, you know, one day to install the game plan, and then they play Boston, and then they're off to the next one. And now when you actually have a full series and you're fully focused on them and you can make adjustments over the course of a series, is that going to hamper their advantage? I would assume so. Or maybe they're so good that they're going to, that it, the same is going to go for them with the opponent, and it's going to be really easy for them to just stomp out whoever gets in their way.
One stat on that really stuck out to me from our mutual friend Seth Partnow is the Celtics are 23-1 this year against teams that are projected to win 35 games or fewer. And so that ties in with your idea of the game planable part of this is a real challenge for them. The only other team that has that same record is the Denver Nuggets. They're an identical 23-1. Almost everyone else has significantly more losses than that. There are a couple that are in the 2-3 range, but generally it's more. And that isn't to say Boston, no, they're only beating up against the bad teams. They're beating everyone. But there will be some of that, which is harder to do because you don't get to face those teams at all in any semblance or form, though there could be a 35-win team that is relatively close to the playoff picture. Thank you, East. And I really love the point that you made about how the Celtics players, their starters, can do everything. And it is a notable parallel with the Oklahoma City Thunder, who at one time it looked like those were going to be the two number one seeds. OKC probably not going to be the one as of now, where that's the theory of OKC is that all their guys, like Sam Presti, really values players who can dribble, shoot, and pass. And for both of them, what it allows the rosters to do and the coaches to do is be more selective about finding their biggest point of advantage. And something that I've loved about the Celtics offense this year is that Kristaps Porzingis is posting up a fair amount, but he's really only doing it when he has an advantage. And that's exactly what Kristaps Porzingis should be doing when it comes to post-ups.
I literally cannot remember in my mind. I can't visualize him posting up another big. Like, I just can't remember it happening.
I don't recall seeing it a single time in all of the Celtics I've watched this year.
Yeah, and I mean, I've been to almost every game this season, and I'm sure there's a few I'm forgetting, but it is rare. It is rare. And actually, Jay King, my colleague at The Athletic, just put out a big feature about Porzingis' kind of revelation of the post-up, which is definitely worth reading. But like what has made the Celtics so good is their whole entire strategy is as soon as we get the ball off of defense, we are looking for a cross match and we're orienting around it. And so, you know, like their play calls are just basically formations. And it's really simply just get into a certain formation and then find the 2-on-1 advantage and attack it. And so they ironically have simplified the way that they operate, but because they can operate in so many different ways, it's probably made them more complex and more difficult to cover. But yeah, I mean, a lot of the time, their offensive success boils down to they just give Porzingis a post up at the nail against a small, and he just hits like, he goes like 5-for-7 on shooting those mid-range shots. And he's just been so deadly on those mid-range shots. It's very rare that he finishes at the rim out of the post. Like, that almost never happens. It's pretty much always just those mid-range shots, but he's been deadly with it.
Boston, I mean, they have a 106.5 first shot half court offensive rating. That is technically that would be the worst offensive league, but that is because that would include no transition. Like that is a preposterous number overall. I don't have historical parallels to that handy right now, but they've been doing it really well there. And Boston, their frequency running hasn't been that high. They're actually towards the bottom of the league in possessions in the half court, like two more possessions in the half court than anybody else. But they have been effective when they've run. But you're right. I mean, that half court offensive theory, and I mean, in some ways, the parallels that I think of with Boston's offense are actually in some ways to other sports of like, we're going to adapt what we do to the coverage that we're seeing in football. For example, like you can have that, like if you read that the other team is playing zone, then maybe you're going to do some more of like flood concepts or something else like that. Because the truth of the matter is, few teams have the combination of talent and coaching to be able to function in that way, but it does seem like it has fit them very well.
Yeah, no, you're right that their offensive, like their offense is completely dictated on the matchups. Like there are games where they close out with getting Porzingis shots at the nail or getting Tatum and Brown clear outs. There's games where it's just Derek White pick and rolls with Porzingis. It's like the way that they close, people will always ask, is their late game offense fixed? Because they're still fixating on like, yeah, Tatum has a lot of empty possessions. And they definitely do still lean too much on giving Tatum isolation opportunities. It is very time and score dependent for sure, but like they're very different in the way they close games. And I don't think that if you look at, you know, certain teams out there, like Denver is very obvious and you know what they're going for. You know, they're going to use Jokic and Murray at different angles at different spots, but like, you know that it's that two-man action kind of dictating everything. And with Boston, they really are calling upon anybody at any moment based on opposing personnel, based on coverages. And that's what's made them so unpredictable.
we got into this a little bit, but do you think that unpredictability is going to work? And for me, I'm thinking more about this in terms of the specific like game that you're facing the same team game after game, but also maybe more importantly, the improved overall defensive talent level of when we're talking more like the conference finals level of opponent. Because I mean, you think back, as much as Jason Tatum's point on this is completely right, that the Celtics are so good that their losses linger, like that you think about them a lot more. But I do think about that one to Denver where they just couldn't create the same advantages offensively because Denver doesn't start any bad defenders.
Yeah, so that's like the big thing is in the playoffs, not only is defense more physical, but the acuity is better. The attention to detail is better. People remembering and understanding all their responsibilities is better. So it's going to be harder for them to like catch teams by surprise. And like teams are going to get better at covering up their weak players. So for instance, a lot of their strategy is wherever there is a weak defender, they just bring the guy he's covering into the ball screen to force a switch. And teams can get creative and pre-switching stuff like that when they can see it coming. And that's going to make it more complicated for the Celtics to find what they want. That can slow down their offense. And then they're getting stuck late in clock. And you can see them really losing their rhythm, losing their tempo. And that could really mess with them. I think what does help them, though, is that most of their core players are good contested shot makers. Like Drew Holiday is pretty good with that. But especially Derek White seems to almost shoot better contested. Mm-hmm. Jason Tatum seems to love shooting contested for some stupid reason. Jaylen Brown only takes contested shots. And Porzingis, it's pretty hard to contest a shot. And even Sam Hauser has been really good shooting contested this year. So it's not like better contests are going to make a huge difference on them. And then defensively, I haven't seen a team yet that really messes with them. But like obviously, that Denver matchup is bad. I'm sorry. Actually, what I should have said is when they're on offense, facing certain defenses, the like Bucks, Nuggets, trying to think who else, I mean Cleveland a little bit, but teams that have length kind of across the board and especially really lengthy wings that can get into the gaps, those are the teams that have really hurt them.
And especially when those squads don't have as many obvious sources. So like, for example, I don't consider Cleveland as dangerous for Boston in a 7-game series because they have to play their small guards. There is no other way for the Cavs to score enough. Whereas like a theoretical Celtics-Wolves series, that gets a little bit more interesting because Edwards is generally defended well in big moments, and Conley can have some struggles, but if he's your worst defender, that's more of a challenge against the Celtics. Still pretty good. And so, but there aren't that many teams like that, honestly, in the league right now, and there really aren't that many in the Eastern Conference who have the luxury of not having limited defenders, like not having any bad defenders in the rotation. And that's kind of ties in with another fascinating question that I have about Boston in the playoffs, is that they've gotten a lot from their bench. They've been better, you know, a lot of people you could praise with that. Sam Hauser's had a better year than I expected in particular, and they brought in, you know, I'm a big Xavier Tillman fan, even if it hasn't been, you know, he's only played 250 minutes for them. But the other teams, so Boston, like, they're going to get better, and theoretically they're not going to have to do as much of the cycling of their roster of their starters and stuff as they've done over the last month plus, which makes their success all the more ridiculous. But it is true that, you know, you could tie this in with Denver being atrocious in the non-Jokic minutes and everything else, that other teams are going to tighten this up too. And something that Boston may end up leading to in the teams that have this luxury is those coaches cutting out some of the limited defenders more than they otherwise would, because it's a lot harder to play. I'm trying to think of the best example of this, like a really good offensive, like let's say a Duncan Robinson type of player. It's harder to do that, and Miami can pull it off better than anybody, but it's harder to have that player on the floor against Boston because they're so used to making that the focal point of what they're going to do offensively.
Yeah, I mean, like you look at potential first round opponents, there's Philly and Miami are the probably two most likely there. You know, those are teams that at fully healthy, like they might have one weak point that they can go after. I think if a team has one weak point in their lineup, that's probably pretty fine. It's when there's two, that's when they're really in trouble. Right. And the irony is they might get that throughout their East run. And it's also hard to just predict just because as of recording, we have absolutely no idea how the East bracket is going to shake out. Like the 2 through 6, even 8 is just so tight at this point. It really could go either way.
And then there, of course, could be upsets in future rounds and everything like that. And there are also, like, something that really helps the Celtics as things look right now is that there isn't another team in the East, and it's unfortunate that the Knicks aren't going to be healthy, that has really put it together on both ends of the floor at the same time. Because that's what you need to beat the Boston Celtics. We've brought up how maybe their offense is going to slow down against certain opponents, and I believe that to be a valid concern. Whether it's true or not, we're going to have to see. Okay, you have a team that's good enough defensively to do that. Well, you also need to be good enough offensively to score on one of the best teams in the league.
I mean, frankly, with the Knicks, it's possible that they might be better off in the matchup against Boston without Julius Randle. If OG is playing really well, Josh Hart is playing 55 minutes a game and getting triple-doubles. DiVincenzo's been really good against them. Hartenstein has been pretty good against them. And Brunson, obviously, has been amazing this year. I could actually see New York still being a really good matchup. And that's a team that kind of consistently over the past few years has been so good against Boston and really overachieved against them just because of their physicality and intensity on defense. Boston is not a power team, even though they are a post-up team. They're not a power team. And when they go up against teams that are smaller but can really get physical at the point of attack and switch up onto them and make them uncomfortable and kind of disrupt their offensive flow, those are the teams that really mess with Boston. So I think New York is still a pretty good matchup.
They present challenges that other teams simply do not. I do think that the renewed points of emphasis for the NBA from an officiating standpoint could actually loom really large in that series, that Jalen Brunson is going to have a harder time of it now than the way that the league was officiated for the first half, two-thirds of the season. Because and you could say that the change that has happened, which finally acknowledged by Commissioner Silver on Wednesday, is that is more like playoff basketball in the first place, so it's probably not going to be as big of a difference as it has been relative to the start of the year. But it is something worth watching. And I want to talk briefly about the bench. I mentioned Sam Hauser.
Hold on one second. One thing. Sure. Didn't Brunson just drop a 40 piece on Alex Caruso like a couple days ago?
He did. Caruso is hurt. He's doing an ankle injury, but you're right. And I mean, Jalen Brunson's one hell of a basketball player. He can still, even if the officiating is less to his advantage than it was, he could still put up some numbers, can still do some work. And especially if they can get back, if they can get more of a full roster of OG and all that stuff, then you have to more actively guard some of their guys. I think the Knicks are going to be heard from in this, and we'll see where the seeding comes in, but they may end up benefiting from that too, but they also might not. We don't know that for sure.
Yeah.
So on the bench front, I mean, I think that's another part of it. Like Boston, I brought this up. In this last stretch, it's been really striking how there haven't been that many games where they've had all five of their best players, or even five or like all six, if you want to count Horford kind of functionally in this, available. But they have been able to get real contributions from some guys outside of that, which has really helped shore up some of their gaps.
As far as like their bench depth?
Yeah, like Sam Hauser and Cornette's had some good minutes and everything else. Like they haven't needed, because you think about it, that yes, the Celtics are really deep 1-6, like the best team in the league to me in that stretch. But they've needed some from other guys, even though, like, you know, Tatum's going to play 75 games, roughly. He may miss Derek White, Jaylen Brown, all those guys are going to hit 70, at least they should. But it's still been impressive, Porzingis missed time, that they've been able to get, you know, like Sam Hauser. I think this has been a breakout season for him.
Hauser has taken a big step forward. I mean, he's taken a step forward every year of his career. It's, you know, he's still pretty early in his career, but he's had a very, very consistent growth where last year he became a good spot-up shooter. This year he's become a good shooter on the move. He shoots tightly contested shots all the time pretty effectively. He's also now able to attack closeouts and make some decent reads off of that. And then defensively, you know, last year opposing teams would just go at him and he would fare pretty well on the aggregate. So his plus minus was like through the roof. I think it was one of the best in the league or something like that. This year, I think opponents have kind of caught on to that he's a solid defender and he's just improved as being a smarter gap defender. He's actually blocking shots from behind a lot of the time now. But he is still somebody that when he's going up against like a go-to scorer, he's still kind of staying off of them and he'll give a solid contest on their shot, but he's letting them get to their spot. So they're still hitting it over him most of the time. So I still see Hauser as being someone who's going to get targeted while he's out there. And then Pritchard, the one thing I think that's been really big for him, not only has he been a pretty good pull-up scorer from deep this year, but over the last month or so, he's just kind of had a breakthrough, and we'll see if it really lasts, where he is driving straight through defenders, and he's waiting until he gets them completely under the rim, and then he'll kind of lean back and put a little floater up. And it'll be very interesting to see if that works in the postseason. But he's gotten like some 6-0 runs in here or there in some of these games just by doing stuff like that. So both him and Hauser have now become a little bit more dynamic as scorers and playmakers, which has allowed them to be, I think at this point, probably playoff ready.
Furthermore, if the Celtics are full strength or close to it, they don't need Hauser and Pritchard to be too far outside of their comfort zone. Like that is a nice place. They're not going to be outstripping them. Now, unfortunately, every team is going to deal with injuries, going to deal with foul trouble during the playoffs. So there will be moments where some of those guys have to step up. And while there are plenty of other Celtics storylines that we can discuss, we have a narrow time frame here. The other big thing that I want to discuss, which is the reason I reached out to you early, I reached out to you this week specifically, as opposed to the other times I have, is the Jrue Holiday extension. And I had heard some murmuring that Jrue wanted to get a deal done before the transition into a new year. He had a player option for 24-25. What can you tell us about kind of how that all went down?
Well, you know, I think he was eligible to sign a deal once April started.
Yes.
And so I figured it was probably pretty likely that he was going to get it done before the postseason, or it wasn't going to get done, period, until, you know, later in the summer. But it's like, okay, so he's taking about what, like a $7 to $10 million discount next year in order to lock up, not just to get a 4-year deal, but he has a player option when he's, I think it's his age 38 season and his 20th season in the league. So if he's still playing at a pretty decent level and the cap has grown a lot by then, and 30 mil or whatever it's going to be at that point is still, you know, if he can do better than that, it gives him that freedom. So I think, you know, it kind of works pretty well for both sides. What's interesting here, it's not they got really good value on him, right? Like they were able to get him to take a haircut. They were able to get that done with Porzingis, which now it's like Porzingis only making 30 mil a year seems pretty wild, right? In hindsight, with the way he's played this year. But Derek White hasn't gotten his deal done yet. We know Jason Tatum is going to get that full supermax in the summer. So Derek White is, if they had to choose between Jrue Holiday and Derek White, I would presume that they would choose Derek White because of his age and his role on offense. But now that they're committed to Jrue, paying White, and you know, they're going to be in the second apron forever. And we don't know what the strategy is going to be with these teams for being in the second apron for more than a couple years in a row. But between that and their repeater tax, we're looking at a tax bill of like $200 to $300 million or something like that. And this team has never seemed like that. Like, I think 75 mil is the most they've ever paid in luxury tax. So it's hard to imagine that they're willing to pay that much. And so this deal makes me think that they probably are going to have to trade one of their core players in a couple of years.
It likely does. Nate and I talked about it on Dunked on Wednesday night, and he brought up the theory, which is really interesting, depending on where the cap number turns out, that the discount that Jrue Holiday, the pay cut that he's taking for the 24-25 season, there is a pathway. They would have to lose a little bit, but probably not that much. The Celtics could actually duck the second apron that year, so next year, and then they could go back over again. That doesn't reset all the clocks, but it just kind of pushes some of the bigger stuff down the road, repeaters and all that fun stuff. But so the other part of this, and it's so funny because you and I had an extended conversation about this back when the Celtics traded for Derek White, a move that I really liked at the time, and of course, like even more now, is that it gives you flexibility. And I think that there is a possibility, depending on how his health is and everything else, that this Jrue Holiday extension leads to the possibility that they choose Derek White over Jrue Holiday, but can still trade him. And they would probably have to save some money in that transaction because that would be the point of it. Like, you're probably not doing that to upgrade because your team is already really good and because you have all this stuff, but they have first round picks and everything else. So I don't think that move is inevitable. I don't think that's there, but it is a possibility that now, when the time comes, if the time comes, that ownership decides this price point is insufficient, as you brought up with the tax, especially with some of the increased penalties that are coming in, being phased in with the new CBA, that point, I still think that point is going to come. But if Drew Holiday's contract is looking reasonable at that juncture, well, then you can get it done. And the reason why this deal happened in part was because I think Holiday wanted the commitment ahead of time. And in part, it was presumably a negotiation from Brad Stevens saying, well, okay, if you want something now, we can do it. But this is the kind of framework that it can't be stronger than this. And that is presumably how they not only got to about a $30 million salary for next year, but also that player option in the last year, so that Holiday can get a little bit of flexibility on the back end in exchange for a more reasonable number on the front end.
Yeah, and I think at the end of the day, this deal is pretty movable. Like Holiday, even if Holiday's production declines, he's such a great locker room piece. He's so instrumental to coordinating a defense, I think. Any contender would be probably willing to trade for him anyway. So if the Celtics really have to pivot off of him, I think they'll be able to. The tricky part for Boston is at this point, they don't have a next wave of like high level starters coming. There's no one in their prospect pipeline that you could see as like this guy could replace Drew Holiday. I assume if they have to just shed one of these large salaries in like 2 years, that's also when I think Sam Hauser's deal is going to be up. So if they can keep Sam Hauser, I'd imagine he would be sliding into the starting lineup. Jordan Walsh, their rookie this year who hasn't played at all, he's the only other person that seems like he has that potential. I don't think Peyton Pritchard's going to be more than a sixth man at this point of his career, and Al Horford's probably going to retire either this offseason or next offseason. So because they're in the second apron and there's not really much that they can do at this point to bring in more talent besides try to package a lot of their draft picks to get high up in the draft before they start having their picks, you know, get traded away from the previous deals they've done. I don't really know how they maintain this strong of a top six, but I guess that's probably just the way things are going to be now with the second apron.
It probably is. And I mean, the Suns are an example of this, the Bucks, the Clippers, that the increased restrictions, which are only going to get stronger for the second apron, that's really going to impact the viability of the 11 to 15 spots. And then you can actually slide that up a fair amount for when you need it, because it's just harder to replace players. It's a portion of why I was really high on the Xavier Tillman acquisition, because I'm not saying that they're necessarily going to retain him, but or that he's as good as Al Horford, obviously. But they can maybe bridge some of that gap there with him. And there are a few other, you know, conversations. You brought up Hauser. Like, I mean, he'll be on a new contract at that point. So he has they have a team option for him next year, which they will almost certainly pick up, because in their case, it's not even the incentive of like, oh, we could lock in a cheaper deal eventually. It's that every dollar for 24-25 could be really important. And so you want to kind of keep that down. And they could potentially, he might be extendable with the little bit more generous rules, maybe not. But the Celtics can cross that bridge if they get to it, and they'll have sufficient bird rights to make everything happen. So I think the last question I want to ask you is, how do you think the decision makers here, so that would be Brad Stevens and ownership, are evaluating success in this postseason? We're coming off this unbelievable run. We've talked about it a lot over this half hour. Is this championship or bust? Is it not? And like, does that actually make a difference? Because their roster seems pretty stable.
It's always championship or bust in Boston, but this year more than ever since 2008. This is the most important season they've had. They have such an advantage. Like, it would be ridiculous if they didn't win the title with the advantage that they have and the way that they're performing. Of course, considering Denver is the one that has beaten them consistently. But, like, they have the third highest net rating in NBA history. If they don't win the title this year, it's like, sure, you could hope that Tatum will probably get better next year. Jaylen Brown will probably get better next year. But, like, if they can't do it this year, it's hard to really hold out hope that they'll ever get it done. I think that means probably one more season of trying it with this core. And if they don't get in either of those, that's when they probably completely blow it up and rebuild around Tatum, I would imagine.
And especially with the Eastern Conference being so soft this year. Now, some of the softness might not be in their part of the bracket for the first round, because it's looking like it's probably going to be Philly or Miami. And that is more dangerous potentially than who the 3 seed and the 4 seed could be facing.
Yeah, you'd rather have the 3 seed at this point, honestly.
Yeah. Unfortunately, we don't have choosing your opponents in the NBA. I think that if they don't do it this year, and obviously there are contexts, you know, if Jason Tatum gets hurt at the beginning of a game seven again, like you can get on also those sorts of things. But this is their best chance. And it would surprise me, honestly, if next year is a better opportunity than this, in part because they're coming in pretty healthy and they have home court and they have an East that's pretty soft. And so, yeah, if you lose in the NBA Finals in a hard-fought series, it could be a little bit different. But this is their opportunity, and the defending champs are a formidable team. And there's no guarantee that they're going to make it out of their side. But, oh boy, is this going to be fun to watch.
Sure. I would say if it's a competitive finals, goes six or seven games, it's really tight, and you feel it's how does it feel at that point? If they feel good, they look good, they played a great team, because Denver is still probably on the same level as them when push comes to shove at the end of the day. And so if that's really close and they lose, then sure, it's like you can feel comfortable going back next year. If they don't make it out of the East with the way that the East has been this year, that is going to be one of the great fails of a great team in recent memory. It absolutely would be. And I think that's obvious, right? Like the Celtics have just been unbelievable this year, and the rest of the East has been an absolute like shit show. And so they should get out of the East.
They should. And now we get to see if it actually happens. I will thank you so much for taking the time.
It's been a pleasure. I'll see you, I'm sure, during the finals.
Lots more to discuss, but first a message from Prize Picks. NBA playoffs are obviously right on the horizon. You can get in on the playoff action and win up to 100 times your money on Prize Picks as you and the world's best players take the game to a new level during basketball's postseason. And you can now win up to 100 times your money on Prize Picks with as little as 4 correct picks. You can turn $10 into $1,000 with basketball, hockey, and college basketball entries today on Prize Picks, America's number one fantasy app. I really like that Prize Picks is player specific to my intuition. I think that works a little bit better. And it's very straightforward. You find the player projection that you find interesting, and then you just go more or less on that number. And that's easy to connect with. And of course, it'll make the playoffs more fun, though they're plenty of fun anyway. And the way that you can check out Prize Picks is you download their app today, and then you use the code CLNS. Because that gets you a first deposit match up to $100. It also tells Prize Picks that you came from us. So download the Prize Pick app today and use the code CLNS for a first deposit match up to $100. Prize Picks. Pick more, pick less. It's that easy. Thanks again to Jared Weiss for taking the time to come on. You can read his excellent work at The Athletic, and he should have plenty of it remaining through the playoffs and everything else. I love talking with Jared and love his appearances on other people's shows and everything else, and his writing. And he does much better work with video than I have ever done, which I always appreciate. And you can find him on social media if you have not already. All right, now it's time to talk to Keith Smith of SpaTrac. We start out with the Jrue Holiday extension too. I thought it'd be good to kind of tuck those together and have that discussion. And then we get into a really fascinating, wide-ranging conversation about how to interpret where the cap is going, how to plan these things from a team perspective. We get into some detail on the Magic and a few others in particular, and how to calibrate what's coming in terms of the new revenues and the new contracts with what we're seeing right now. So I thought it was a great conversation, some stuff that I hadn't put together, some stuff that will be very useful for you all if you're so inclined to listen to this kind of podcast, which I think you are. And as I said, it runs well over an hour. Lots of good stuff in here. Thank you so much for coming on.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
This is a two-part pod. I actually recorded with Jared Weiss right before this. And I want to start with you where I ended with him, which is the Jrue Holiday extension that came down on Wednesday. And 4 years, 135 is basically the same extension that he agreed to, obviously in a different cap and personal environment for him than the one he agreed to in Milwaukee. So with Jared, I talked more about the kind of what this does for the Celtics' money, and we'll talk about that too. But what was your first reaction when you saw that the deal came down and what the terms were?
No surprise that the deal came down. If anything, I thought it would have got done almost right around when guys are eligible. It seems like these things either happen right when a guy is eligible, or it takes all the way until like we're at the last day to do it. But for whatever reason, it took as long as it took. So that part wasn't surprising. The number was maybe a little more than I thought it would be, but not enough so that it was like, oh my gosh, what happened here? I thought it might come in closer to like the 120 to 125 mark. And who knows? Maybe we'll find out, well, that's the max with incentives or whatever it is with that. But yeah, I think it's a pretty fair number, even if I feel pretty confident it's not going to look so great in the last year or so.
There were plenty of incentives for both sides to come to some sort of an understanding. It appears that Holiday wanted the stability of that. He has extended a lot over the course of his career. It's one of the, and I mean, hey, if you can get the money before you're at risk, like, I completely understand it. And for Holiday, so you, not only is it the security of that, but it's, I mean, this is 3 new years at significant money, and you're taking a discount, as we expect, in 24-25, but not that big a haircut. You know, this is more in the like 10-ish million dollar range. We don't have the exact figures yet, and that's pretty big. So from their perspective, and then for Boston, it's you get kind of secure one of the remaining pieces before the postseason push, which is important, but also the idea that should he have hit the open market, Drew Holiday could have had some very motivated suitors, even though this has been an unusual year for him. Guys who can defend really well, his shooting this year has been really striking. I mean, 43% on threes. Don't expect that to continue, but he's career 37. So he's a good shooter. And of course, a wonderful defensive player. So for example, would Philadelphia have come knocking? You know, he's has experience there too. I think they would have. I think other teams could have as well. And like, I mean, I think what might put a cold shiver down various team spines now with this is Fred VanVleet, where VanVleet, a very good player, but not an all-star, not that kind of level. And I think that's fairly what Drew is right now. And he still got his maximum allowable for 2 years with a team option for the third. And that would have been less overall of a commitment for the Celtics, but it would have been more in years that would have caused some real pain.
Yeah, absolutely. And I know one of your favorite sayings is years, not dollars. I think in this case, it becomes a lot for Drew Holiday. Is my guess is there were two parts to this. One where, hey, if I'm going to take this 9-10 million, we'll figure it out when the number actually comes in, haircut next year, I need that fourth year. And then I think it probably became, hey, can we do a player option? And I have to believe the Celtics were probably at this point of, what difference does it really make with a player option? We're not going to let this whole thing fall apart over something that's 4 years away. I've become very fond of saying, for teams that are in this position where you're pushing for a championship and you're extremely expensive, let tomorrow's problems be tomorrow's problems. And I think for Boston, it is, is there a chance that becomes a problem? Yeah, absolutely. There's some sense of this might have been better to front load this deal and take the hit now. But then as Jaylen Brown and eventually Jason Tatum and probably Derek White's contracts will go up, 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 you are Holidays is coming down. But I can also understand the idea of, hey, let's save a bunch of money right now, because it's not just 9 or 10 million in salary. It's like 40 million in luxury tax penalties on top of it. So that becomes like a whole other piece. And I got to believe Brad Stevens, when he sat down with ownership to say, hey, here's where we're at, this is going to save this, but can you make sure you remember this in 2 years when I'm coming back and saying, hey, that 40 million I saved us 2 years ago, I need it now. Now I need it to come in. And I think that's important. I think there's also an element to this too for Boston, and it's something you and I have talked about in the past, is they're committed now to being a second apron team for the foreseeable future. And in the NBA, that's like 3-4 years. Like, you can't really get too locked in beyond the next 3-4 seasons. But I think what they've done with this Drew Holiday deal is, at the end, they now have some salary ballast that they can put into a trade where it is, hey, even if we are at a point where it is, we still believe in Tatum and Brown, but we've got to rejigger the rotation around those guys. We have to rework it and bring in some new guys. We need another big alongside Porzingis, because Horford presumably will have retired by then or whatever it is. Now you have 35-ish million or so by that point in tradable salary, where otherwise you wouldn't have had that, and you would have been stuck to, hey, what minimum signings might work out for us? So I think that's probably a more minor part of this, but I think that probably factors in some level as well.
I think it does. And one other way of thinking about this deal, so Drew Holiday, I'm going to flash forward a few years to the the third year of this extension. So basically the 26-27 season. So at that point, that will be Drew Holiday's age 36 year. And he's, you know, making, we don't know the exact numbers yet, but roughly around $35 million. That sounds like a lot of money, because it is. But running my projections the way that I do, so basically I have a system within my Excel where I build in estimates for future cap years. Mm-hmm. And if I'm with my rough estimate for then, that'll be about 20% of the cap at that point, because if the increases with the new national TV deal go the way I expect it. So that's manageable. You know, it's still high, and we don't know how good a 36-year-old Drew Holiday is going to be, but the idea that it could be movable. And the other point of comparison here is I was surprised that it's 4 years, you know, that it went out that far, and that it's a player option. I'm guessing the fight on that was player option versus fully guaranteed, rather than like player option versus non-guaranteed, because then that probably would have been too big of a bridge to negotiate. And at that point, for Boston, the way to think about this is like, okay, if it was fully guaranteed versus a player option, the only way he's declining that player option is if things worked out so well, or the cap is so big that he thinks he can do better. And if 37-year-old Drew Holiday can do better, more power to him.
Yeah. Yep. Yeah, I think that's really important too, because yeah, if Drew Holiday can do better than that, well then the Celtics for quote unquote won this extension, because that means he is still really, really good. And I love the way you framed it, in that it'll be 20% of the cap. And that's where I think collectively you see these numbers. These number, I like to say we're in the territory of this all being just monopoly money now, because it doesn't feel real anymore, like how big these contracts are getting. I mean, Jaylen Brown next year, if everything comes in exactly as projected, is starting an extension that's going to pay him $286 million. Like almost that's over a quarter of $1 billion on his extension alone. And I think what people have lost sight of is $35 million. Yeah, that's a huge number, but that's not even approaching a max deal. By the time the year you called out, 3 years, if the cap goes in kind of where I loosely have it projected to go in at, a max deal for Drew Holiday that year will be almost $60 million. Yeah. So you're talking a little over half. Like that's, and I think that just kind of gives a little perspective for folks of, yeah, it, don't get me wrong, somebody walks in the house tonight and says, want $35 million? Yeah, I'm taking it, no matter what, where I'm at. I'm happy to have it. That's still going to be a ton of money even 3 years from now for Drew Holiday. But it's in NBA terms, it's kind of that's what you pay for a good starter. And now that becomes a question. Will he still be a good starter at that point? And I think the important thing with the player option is, if Drew Holiday is good enough to opt out, that's a win for the Celtics. And if he's not good enough to opt out, well, then you hope, all right, well, we can pay a little bit for past performance here, because you hope sometime between this year and the next couple of years after this one, he'll have helped deliver a team that's either in the finals or wins the finals. And for me, then that's kind of the price of doing business. Sometimes you pay a little bit on the back end for the things the guys do on the front end. This is the whole idea I have. Once a player hits over a certain age, I would love to see them allow, it wouldn't apply it here, but I'd love to see what I call a reverse max, which is guy still gets the max money. We just reverse the cap hits, so it comes in on the front end if the team and player want to do it that way. So that way you still get exactly what you would have gotten otherwise, but it just helps the team as the player ages out, and it probably isn't worth the full max. They're making considerably less. And it used to be an 8% decline was a million or $2 on a max. Now we're talking, as these contracts grow and grow, we're talking, you know, 4 and 5, 6, 7, 8 million as we get there. So it's just something I've noodled around in my head.
I had a different concept of the same problem earlier in my career, where I think I wrote this for Sporting News about the idea that you could, with certain criteria, it would have been tenure with the same team, maybe like half of your money counts against the cap and the tax. And that the wild thing about that is those approaches back then were a little bit unnecessary, but now with the aggressive aggressiveness of the second apron and everything else, what that would do to mitigate some of this is it would reward homegrown teams in a different way. Yeah. I'm not saying the league is going to do it, and there already are precedents of players that count at different numbers for the cap tax and the and their actual salary, but this would be a much larger scale version of that than has ever existed. And there is some motivation for the league to kind of go in that direction. And one more thing on Drew before, and this is something Jared Weiss and I talked about, there could be a point, because Jared talked about the idea that this could eventually lead to a decision with Holiday and Derek White, because White's going to be, he'll be on a new contract in 25-26, whether presumably with the Celtics, but it could be with someone else. And the point I brought up was, I'm like, well, this, the one of the things that I think the Celtics should feel good about with the Holiday contract is, knowing what we know now, there is a possibility that if in 25 they have to make a decision between the two, would prefer White at his number to Holiday at his number. I think Holiday, unless he gets hurt, his number, that he could get moved at that point. So one of the goals when you sign an extension is that or a new contract like Jeremy Grant's, is that a year or two down the line, there could be a circumstance where that player ends up not being in your plans, like that they can do that, and you can get out of it relatively cleanly, or I mean, in an ideal world, you get out of it with a premium or something like that. But some wishes are a little bit too grand, and I'm not saying that necessarily in Drew's case. I'm saying, and you know, generally speaking, these contracts are going to be fair value or close to it, and so for Boston, as I'm looking at it right now and seeing where the league climate is going, 25-26 happens to be the year that the new TV deal money will kick in. I think they'll be okay. And so if that's the decision that Brad Stevens comes to at that juncture, they could do it.
Yeah, I'm with you on that. I think where we're at with the Celtics in this is there was immediately this uproar upon Holiday's the extension news breaking of, well, I guess Derek White's gone. I think some people for some reason have in their head, and this is people I know who cover the league, that think Derek White is a free agent this summer, and he's not. He's got one more year left under contract. So Derek White will be with the Celtics for, because he hit his three-pointers made bonus this year, which it's kind of funny. It seemed like that was one of those funny money bonuses thrown in there years ago when he signed this deal. Then he's actually now hit it, and he's going to make over $20 million next year. But I think what's interesting is next year, they're okay. They're actually fine. They actually helped themselves a little bit.
Quick thing on that. Nate has an operating theory that the Celtics could actually get under the second apron next year with a couple of moves. We don't know that for sure. Depends on Tillman and Cornett and a few other things, but it is possible.
Yeah, it's going to be super tight for them to pull that off. I've got them probably second apron, if I'm doing very quick math here in my head. Probably that would mean probably shedding about $6-7 million. So that might cost you a decent rotation player. And I think a lot of that we'll find out what happens here in the playoffs, right? If they make it, I think they'll say, all right, let's more or less run it back. We often see title teams take that approach, and we'll add a draft pick, and we'll add a couple minimum guys, and off we'll go with that. And I think we've seen them kind of operate in a sense of, we're going to handle things as they come up. And Derek White is not, they can't extend him right now. They could extend him this summer. I don't know that he signs an extension. I think even with the improved extension rules, I just don't know that it's going to be enough for him to do that. I think, you know, again, we'll kind of see the way the rest of this year goes. It'll bring him up to about $27.4 million if he extended. Well, actually slightly higher, because it'll be at $20 million. So it'll be a little bit higher than that. But I'm just not sure that's going to be enough for Derek White. I think he may be saying, hey, I want to be in the $30 million range. You know, in my first year. So that may go into free agency in 2025. But I think then that turns people into, well, they're going to lose him. Well, that doesn't mean that. That just means he can make more money. And sometimes it's better for guys to go into free agency. So I really think next year is fine. And then let's see if the TV money comes in good and in a good place, we're definitely going to be in a spot where they'll be extremely expensive. Don't get me wrong. They're still probably going to be pushing up against that second apron, but they'll have a little bit of clear. It's Al Horford will be off the books by that point. Peyton Pritchard's contract's extremely movable. Jaden Springer will have come off the books. His salary's not very big, but you could replace that with a minimum. And you just kind of get in a spot where you're kind of consistently rotating that bottom of the roster and churning it. The guy who becomes really interesting to me in this whole thing, because I don't think they're going to let finances be a difference in letting Derek White get out the door. What happens with Sam Hauser? Because he's a key rotation guy. Teams generally still will pay for shooting to an extent. We saw like Max Strus got a really nice contract this summer based on basically being a shooter. And I think there's a world where Sam Hauser could be the guy who gets priced out of this whole thing. Because even if, let's say they win the championship this year, then let's say next year they're in the finals or even win back-to-back titles, there's still going to be a point where ownership's going to say, all right, Jaylen Brown at $50 million, Tatum at $50 million, Porzingis 30, Holiday like 33, White at 30. Yeah, sorry, you can't have Sam Hauser too at, you know, 8, 9, 10 million. Like he's got to go, you know, figure it out, go identify the next Sam Hauser. So that's where it gets a little more interesting to me. But you're talking the ninth guy on the roster in 2 years from now. So that's, again, that's one of those, let that be tomorrow's problem.
It really is. Lots more to discuss, but first a message from Factor Meals. Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from weekly menu of 35 options, including popular ones like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. And you can discover more than 60 add-ons every week, like breakfast, on-the-go lunch, snacks, and beverages to help you stay fueled and feel good all day long. If you're looking for gourmet meals, they have meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. They're no fuss, no muss, which is one of my absolute favorite things about them. And they can be tailored to your schedule. You can customize weekly meals with the flexibility to get as much or as little as you need. You can pause and reschedule deliveries. And so you should check it out. Go to factormeals.com/realgm50, R-E-A-L-G-M-50, and use the promo code realgm50, same thing, to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box, which is absolutely fantastic. So again, go to factormeals.com/realgm50 and use that realgm50 promo code to get half off your first box and 20% off your next while your subscription is active. That is fantastic. Check them out. I want to transition, but building off of something that you brought up, which I think is it's a point that's worth really delving into, which is the idea of how much more money there is going to be in the pot. And Nate and I have used the shorthand for a long time of like life-changing money. And that line is different for everybody. I mean, you could say that even a minimum contract for most people would be life-changing money. But what one of the elements that I'm really fascinated in as this, especially as this new TV deal kicks in, so starting in 25-26 is, how does that affect the decisions that players make, not at the max level, but at more of the like mid-level, like the mid-level exception? And so I'll lay this out a little bit. So Real GM's estimate for the 25-26 season, which is the first year of the new TV money, is 155.1 mil. And by the way, so you can note, that is, so if you go back to 2014, so 10 years ago now, the league-wide salary cap was, you know, 58.7 million. So how big of a change that is overall in the league. So
it's so absurd. Sorry to interrupt you, but it's just so absurd when you look at it. And that's why I love the Real GM layout for it. Cause it just jumps off the page, like screams off the page of like, look at what's happened here. You know, like how much this has grown. Like we've tripled, you know, the cap or more, you know, here pretty soon. Like it's just wild to think of it in that context.
And because the exceptions are tied to the cap themselves, they're going to go up. And so I want to let people know these are the first year salaries for the exceptions in that with that 25-26 estimate. The non-taxpayer MLE starts at 14.1 million. The room exception 8.8, and the taxpayer MLE 5.7, which is that one's more limited. That was one of the big changes in the new CBA, was weakening the taxpayer MLE, which very few teams are actually able to use now, but it is still weaker. And so I wonder how players in that mold, and then a player who's going to make a little bit more than this that we can use as a proxy with this is Malik Monk this offseason. Clear non-max players, but clear well over the minimum. And does a difference of $3 million a year matter less to them when it's 17 to 20 than it did when that was 7 to 10? And my answer is intuitively yes. Like the idea of the marginal value. I mean, money is still money, but you don't need it quite as much. But there's prestige, you know, there's prestige with that. You also have agents who get a cut of it that would definitely be motivated not only to get a larger cut, but also to have that larger number attached to their name and everything else like that. And we'll get some of that answer in the 2024 offseason. I brought up Malik Monk for a reason, because the Kings are artificially limited in terms of what they can offer him due to the early bird rights. But, and we don't know what other teams are going to have on the table. But those decisions over the next few years are going to really fascinate me. Do we see players in certain circumstances not leave money on the table, like, oh, this guy took a minimum? Like, we've seen that a lot over the years, like David West and, I mean, Iguodala at various moments in time and everything else. But I use the Warriors because I know their cap sheet better. But that is something different. I'm talking more like somebody saying, hey, $5 million is great, $5 million a year, but if I would rather be a high-end rotation player on a championship-caliber team than be a starter on a bad team. It's their prerogative, whatever they want to do there. Will we see those sorts of decisions shift as the overall landscape just gets, the rising tide has lifted all boats? Does it just change the way they think about this?
Yeah, it's a really great point. I also wonder, do we see an increase, again, Malik Monk, I think, is a great example for this, of guys doing a version of what Bobby Portis did, which is, all right, I'll do one more year on cheapish money with an option, knowing the plan is I'm going to opt out of it, and then you have my full bird rights, and then you can make me whole. There was a point in time where I remember with Miami, and I'm not accusing them of doing anything illegal, but they did some kind of shenanigans with Goran Dragic's contracts a couple years, where it was, hey, we're going to take you down because we want to use cap space, but then we're going to pay you the year after. And really what we're doing is we're saying, hey, look at this as one big contract just chunked up in ways we can really maximize some cap space here. And it's fine. I mean, that's part of what happens with bird rights, is you have the ability to say, all right, we're going to do this with a guy in here. So I wonder, do we see some of that? I tend to think even when it sometimes feels like that's what should happen, I feel like a lot of players still are in the mindset of, I have to get my money now. I have to get it. And I think anytime you see something like Giannis go down on a non-contact injury, grabbing the back of his leg, every guy who is a free agent's like, yeah, that all sounds good of you'll take care of me in a year, but what if I don't have in a year?
Yeah.
You know, where am I at?
So, and you think about the volatility with injuries, but also with organizations where there's not even a guarantee that the person who would make you that sort of a loose understanding that is not binding, so it is not circumvention necessarily in that sort of circumstance. Harden is another prominent example. Another one is Dirk Nowitzki, who did some maximum minimum dances. And so not only did they get him at a low salary, but they got a low cap hold for the following year, which it would be really, really valuable for some of these teams if they could ever convince a guy to pull it off.
And yeah, you just need to have an extreme level of trust. And obviously a guy like Dirk, 2 decades with an organization, you feel pretty good about saying, hey, yeah, all right, how do we want to work this? Go. When I use Dragic as an example, he obviously had a great relationship at that time with Pat Riley and the Heat and Andy Ellsberg and everybody there. So it was very easy to say, all right, I get where you're going with this. It helps everybody. Let's go. It's interesting. The other thing I think that's going to become very interesting is it's semi-related to that, but it's more on the team side is, I kind of touched on a little bit with Holiday. How many players are we going to start seeing, especially for teams that are, let's say, either at or over the second apron, and know we're going to be dealing with the second apron for a little bit here and all of the restrictions that come with that? How many guys are going to get, I'm going to say, a slightly artificial bump in salary, meaning, all right, where we really feel like your worth is an average of $32 million a year, we're going to bump it to 40, because by the time you're actually making, you know, near that range, we're probably going to be looking at moving you. And that just gives us more salary to move, because teams under the new second apron rules, like if we go back to Boston, they can't take, all right, we're going to trade Kristaps Porzingis and Peyton Pritchard as a combined $38 million and go get ourselves a $45 million player because they're up and over the second apron in a couple years. That wouldn't be something they'd be able to do. But what they would be able to do is take Jrue Holiday as a $38 million player and, all right, we're going to break him up into two guys who make $12 million and $15 million, and that's where we're going to go. Save a little bit of money. We'll go. The other team gets him. We'll probably have to incent them with a draft pick or a young player or whatever it is to do it. So I think those are going to be some of the games. The challenge is going to be that's where front office and ownership have to be in lockstep of, hey, we can course correct if need be. You have to be really careful because you walk a fine line where you're a little too far with that of, hey, at least they're still matching salary. Yeah, but now they're matching salary. That's horrible. And
yeah, exactly.
Now we're paying a premium. So I think we're going to see a little bit of that be kind of the game theory here as we move forward, which is going to be kind of fun to watch how these these teams operate, especially the ones that know, all right, the second apron's not just a problem for us for a year. This is going to be a thing we're going to have to operate under for the next few years.
The walking trade exception is going to have a revival because of these restrictions, and yep. It's going to be so weird because it's going to come with the most expensive teams. And I mean, the Clippers with Eric Gordon, I understand why they didn't do it, because that money and way. Though it would have in certain ways made the eventual Harden trade a lot easier logistically for them. They actually would have had a much better roster if Ballmer was willing to pay it. But it is a big sales pitch. You brought this up in terms of Stevens and Celtics ownership earlier, but it'll be for everyone that's getting in there. And then something else that is going to be worth watching here, and it's unfortunate that the 2024 free agent class is as lackluster as I believe it is. I have a piece coming up soon at The Athletic that should be talking about this, about how it's like, it's decent on stars, but most of them probably aren't going to change teams. It's weak, really weak on starters to me. And then it's pretty solid on rotation players. But so the reason why this year looms large in this is because the cap probably isn't going to go. I mean, we just got that new estimate from the NBA, which is the estimate is like, don't think this is going way higher. Things are going to stay where they are. It could, I mean, honestly, at this point, the biggest variance is probably how long these playoff series go. And because the revenue and gate and all that kind of stuff can shift. But the point that I wanted to make here is you always want, as teams, you always want to try to get players if you can the year before the jump. And the reason why is because everything will recalibrate. And typically, though maybe not in 25, teams are more flush. So you're competing against a different group of talent. So you could argue that that would put, you know, like it might be better to be a little bit more aggressive, especially in years with somebody like OG Anunoby, if you're the Knicks or someone else, or Hartenstein or Siakam. Potentially, Siakam's a little older, so things get a little more complicated with him. But the challenge of that this year, and you could say the same with some of the restricted guys, though restricted guys generally, the pressures on them are a little bit different. There aren't as many of those opportunities this year. And one of the other differences in play here, and I don't know how this is going to affect things, though I know it will, is Philadelphia. Because if the Knicks and the Pacers respectively do not bid aggressively for Anunoby and Siakam, it's not the Sacramento leverages, as Nate used to call it with the Kings. Like, this is a potentially title valid team that can offer you basically the same money other than a fifth year that these other teams can. So they will get leveraged that way.
Yeah, Philly is beyond fascinating to me. I was talking with someone who's in the league, and I was just laughing about how I was doing my first pass at 24-25 depth charts. And what I basically do is I take everybody who's not under contract, inclusive of options, and I go through and I make, all right, I think this option will be picked up, this one won't be, all that. I do the same thing with partial and non-guarantees. And I get to the point when I get to Philly, it is Joel Embiid and Paul Reed are the only two guys.
Like, Paul Reed's contract isn't even guaranteed unless the Sixers advance to the second round.
Yep. And I tend to think I don't know that Daryl Morey's going to be like, man, I really need this $7 million in cap space, so I got to just straight up waive Paul Reed, because that just seems a little too reckless to me. So I'm still projecting him, even if they don't make the second round, to stick around, but we'll see.
One quick thing on the Paul Reed thing. As I have it, though my notes are probably from SpotTrack, Paul Reed's contract actually doesn't guarantee until the cutdown date.
Correct. So he's got plenty of time.
So that means they could see what they can do with that space and then make a decision, which is what you really love as a team. Like those late guarantee dates, this came up with Jonathan Isaac actually. Late guarantee dates on big money contracts are actually really useful for teams because you buy yourself a few weeks of decision time.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's also why we see sometimes those guys who are like, this is more like a fringe roster guy who's making maybe the minimum or slightly above. We'll often see them, they'll push back the guarantee date and push it back because otherwise it's, all right, we're either going to waive you right now or maybe you'll stick. And that seems to be about a 75-25 proposition that the guy ends up sticking, because often the team's like, all right, we didn't need it, so we're happy to keep you around and we'll just guarantee you. But yeah, it's so there's a world like we were just laying out where if Paul Reed comes off the books, Jeff Doughton comes off the books, and then they wipe all of the free agents away minus Tyreek Maxey's cap hold, the only player on contract is Joel Embiid, which is like, we're so close to my dream scenario is someday some team literally walks in with nothing. They've got the minimum roster holds on there, the roster charges, and that's it. And it is true, absolute max cap space. Let's go. I want to see it happen sometime. But this is probably as close as we're ever realistically going to get. But the point is, Embiid and Maxey alone, or just fill them out with like average replacement player level guys, that's a playoff team, especially the way the bottom of the East looks. So then you turn it into, now we can add. That's why, yeah, it's funny. I love the term the leverages. I think of them, they truly become the cap space boogeyman, because yes, guaranteed Paul George right now, part of his leverage is if the Clippers are like, yeah, we really need you to do the Kawhi extension where it's not full years and it's not full money, we that's what we want. His leverage is, okay, I'm just going to go to Philly and be in arguably maybe even a better spot to contend because the conference is just that much weaker. So I'm going to jump and go. And that's where that becomes a really interesting point. To your point, there's not a ton of good free agents that are going to start pulling that game, because something tells me James Harden's probably not going to play that card. But it's still the handful of guys who are out there are good. I think it also becomes the handful of guys who maybe Philly can start sending messages to some of the guys who are, hey, maybe don't sign an extension, because we'll just roll it back. We'll do a whole bunch of, we'll maybe even overpay a couple guys, but on 1 year contracts, run it back. And in the summer of 2025, we'll play this game again, Donovan Mitchell or whoever else, if we want to be there. And that's where it can get really fun. And if you could tell me any GM in the league is going to get super creative and play some games, Daryl Morey is a pretty good bet to do it.
The 25 possibility is really tantalizing, because unlike 24, like, there are some real possibilities. That group will inevitably thin with extensions and everything else. That's the way this happens.
Yep.
But we could see a lot of different, I mean, and because of the cap increase, not a spike, but the float up that will happen in 25-26 by everyone's estimation, there are some players like Jalen Brunson may be functionally unextendable. I haven't worked on the numbers yet. I've been waiting for the cap number to come in for this year so I can build it off next year to see where all that's going to go. And there'll be some who either they want to see how the circumstances play out, they want to wield some leverage, and I mean, there could be that. And one of the other, like, I mean, I brought this up briefly to Nate and Crystal Ball, is old friend Jimmy Butler is going to have extension negotiations this year. And if he wants a number that Miami's going to balk at, now, Morey is typically a tough negotiator on those kinds of things too. So the reason Jimmy Butler would leave would presumably be they won't pay him the money and someone else will. That someone else might not be the 76ers. But he's in that game. Brandon Ingram is potentially in that game. Not that I love the Ingram Embiid fit personally, but yeah, sure. a lot of there are a lot more compelling players potentially in that camp. And so we don't know, and I'm not going to even talk about the restricted guys, because restricted players almost never change teams in this kind of fashion. But the Sixers could run it back. And then the other thing that they can consider doing, and this is an endeavor that, again, I would feel more confident in Daryl Morey succeeding in than most, is they could use their cap space not for free agents. They could do trades. Mm-hmm. They could even do imbalance trades. They can't do imbalance trades where they're sending guys out because they have no guys. But I mean, maybe they could get somebody in something else. So they use that cap space.
Maybe they could do sign-in trades where they're that's how they're you
sure
know,
or something else.
But and
it's
more complicated for sure.
And that could take a variety of forms. I mean, it could be this is a good player, but he's a little bit overpaid sort of a mm-hmm. circumstance. It could be this, like, we're taking on this bad money to get this good money, or a lot of other things. And the beauty of Philadelphia's situation is you have a one, Tyrese Maxey, you have a five in Joel Embiid, and then you have nothing in the middle. And yep. So that means you can, the challenge for Morey is going to be everything. The beauty of basketball is that it's collaborative and codependent. So it's not just like get the best shooting guard, the best small forward, the best power forward you can, and oh, you'll just be fine. Like fit and personality and everything else matter a lot. But there are a lot of different ways to build out from there. And the challenge that, like, so you need to be cohesive and you need to be deliberate, but you can be having a lot of conversations. And if there's one thing I know about Daryl Morey's reputation around the league, it's that he has a lot of conversations.
Yeah. He is the one who is making calls on everybody, right? And it gets just, you know, he talked about it too. I thought what was really interesting was he said, and it's kind of funny because he did it where Danny Ainge did it more than he gets credit for. But he said one of the things he learned working for Danny Ainge was you want to pile up assets so when you have the chance to do something, you can. You don't want to be sitting there and, oh my gosh, this player is available and we just can't even get involved because we don't have the ability to pull it off. And we've seen him, his assets are a little different. They're not loaded with a million draft picks, but they're loaded with a ton of cap space. I want to go back to something you said, too, because it's been kind of bouncing around in my head as well, is Jalen Brunson. And this is the idea of this is where potentially a declining contract can go really, really wrong.
Yes.
For you. He is set this year, makes about $26.5 million. Next year, he'll go down to just under $25 million. So that means his functional number that he can extend to is almost $35 million. I think we're all in a world where that's less than a rookie scale max projects to be that first year. Mm-hmm. He's going to be a $50 million guy, if not a full max guy. I think there's better chance he's probably a full max guy. So I think that's one where, don't get me wrong, I get excited too when I see, oh, this guy's contract descends. But if we get to a point where it's like, oh man, he way outplayed the deal and is better than anybody ever thought he would be, now all of a sudden it's, well, now we can't do anything with it. And his is a very big extreme example because he's been so very good for this Knicks team. But there's other guys as you kind of look around the league and it's like, yeah, that one could maybe a year or two from now become a problem where I think we're going to see maybe a handful of these teams where extensions have really been, that's the way business gets done now in the league, is through extensions and trades. I think we may see a handful of teams where it's, you know, we really think Brunson could pop, or the next Jalen Brunson, where let's just do the standard structure where it goes up, because then maybe we have a little bit better of a chance of extending the guy at the end. I mean, that's part of the reason, like, OG Anunoby was never, he's extension eligible right now. He's never going to extend because his number would be too small. He'd leave way too much money on the table. Kind of to circle it back to what we started with, it's kind of the same issue with Derek White. His isn't a declining deal. It's just his last number is too small for it to be realistic to probably extend him off it. So that's where these declining, descending contracts sound great in theory, and they look really good on a cap sheet right up until it's time to talk extensions. And you're like, you're a little short. And then all of a sudden it's, all right, I'm going into free agency. And then who knows? You know, because a guy like Brunson hits free agency, that could change a whole lot of things versus just the Knicks saying, hey, this is dumb. We know you're not changing teams. Well, we'll see. Because a lot of that will depend on, well, where are we at? you know, what are we looking like as a team by that point?
And that could change significantly or very little between now and then, depending on how everything goes for the Knicks. And the other avenue that some teams have to change that is through a renegotiation and extension. And that happened notably with DeMontis Sabonis last summer. And I firmly believe that it's going to happen without Lauri Markkanen this summer, assuming that he and the Jazz are both interested in such an arrangement. Because for the player, there's a pretty huge benefit. We talked about risk before to securing it now. And so the idea is you use a portion of your cap space to give the player a raise. And while this is not the Robert Covington balloon payment where he got, you know, the Sixers had a ton of money, the process Sixers paid it to him and then reduced off of that, this would be give him the money so you can get the commitment a year early. But the unfortunate thing is that you brought up how extensions or how teams do business now is there is such a decreased utility to cap space. Still valuable, still a lot of different ways you can get talent with it. But it's not as useful if the best players don't truly become available in that fashion, and it can facilitate. But then the other part of it is that if we're dealing more in an extension world, then you probably need cap space plus assets. Because unless you're a major market team or the rules don't apply to you for whatever reason, because those players aren't becoming available for no cost, they're becoming available and you still have to have the best offer available. So I wonder where that's going to go, and like the circumstances where the renegotiation extension is available seem more like happenstance than planning, just because, you know, you have to have so little else on your books to like have enough. And it is also a material sacrifice. It is a justifiable one. I don't love DeMontis Sabonis, but I understood why the Kings did what they did. And then for the Jazz, there are a lot of things they could do with $20 million in cap space, but I don't think any of them are as important to them as retaining Lauri Markkanen.
Yeah, and if I'm also from Lauri Markkanen's standpoint, he was a guy who the current contract he's on, he lingered forever in restricted free agency. That was a very late deal that got done that sent him from Chicago to Cleveland. And that was one of those things where it was like, all right, let's take a shot. It was because he hadn't shown a whole lot, so he did not get paid a lot. So I think for him, the idea is like, I don't know that it gets to the max, like what Sabonis approached on his, but I think it is a sense of, hey, if you're sitting on 30, 40 million in cap space, why don't you give me a whole bunch of it? And then we'll kind of build everything else off of that. And we'll figure it out from there. And I think that's, you know, going to be really important because, yeah, for Utah, I don't know that they're sitting there pitching. And what's also funny, too, as much as we did, and I'm the first one, I made a whole meme where it is the bus driver from The Simpsons saying, don't make me tap the sign. When people are like, who cares if they have cap space? There's no good free agents. And it's like, the sign says cap space can be used to do more than just sign free agents. But there's a huge difference. Like I look at it, just staring us in the face this summer, the Philadelphia 76ers having $60 million in cap space is a very, very different thing than the Detroit Pistons having $60 million in cap space.
Well, yes, it is.
It's one of those teams is, even if I am, I hate to keep bringing them up because it feels like Cavs fans are going to be like, why are you doing this to us? But if Donovan Mitchell signals, I'm out, I don't want to go anywhere, there's a huge difference between Philly saying, hey, we're pretty close to New York where you love home. And guess what? You're going to pop right in here and compete. And I don't love the Maxi Mitchell fit personally, but I'm just using it as an example. But then Detroit saying, hey, we'll trade for him and bring him into our cap space, because Detroit would have to be doing that with the sense of, yeah, it might only be 1 year here, where Philly could do it. Philly's looking at it saying, yeah, we're going to do it with the idea of we're going to keep you. We're going to re-sign you. We're going to do all this stuff. And that's where it gets to be very, very interesting. I think what's cap space will always have a level of value, but I think it's going to be an even more important sliding scale of how much do you have, who is available, and who are you that has it? Because it's where I think we're past the years of, hey, Charlotte has $50 million in cap space, they're going to go get Gordon Hayward, because I just think some teams are not necessarily going to operate that way. And then you also have, I think players are going to be like, I don't know. Because if I go there and they spend all their money on me and this other guy, now I'm stuck. Where are we going? And I think that's going to be things that are really interesting. That's quite frankly why I'm a little nervous for the Orlando Magic, because where they've slid in the standings this year, if they take the approach of maybe we are a year early, let's be patient. If that ability to be super flexible runs out so fast, once you have to have it to start extending Franz Wagner and then extending Paolo Banchero. And it's funny because I've had people be like, how are you already talking about Paolo Banchero extending? And I was like, because it's only a year away. Like,
it is.
Like we're almost there already. Like, that's how fast these things happen, you know, in the NBA. And it's that's why you've got to be, you have to get it right. And when you're in that kind of place, you have to get it right, and you have to get it right quickly, because your window to do these things, it's going to expire way before I think sometimes teams are even ready to make those decisions. You have to be really solid in your projections of this is what we need to put us in the next level.
I had a conversation recently with somebody about that with Victor Wembanyama, who is in his first year right now, but it was the idea, because in San Antonio's case, it's because they're a long way away. And so if they're going to sign players that kind of line up with that sort of a timeline, there will be a constraint, because Victor Wembanyama, as well as he's played, we can expect that he will be on a significant contract. Vassell's contract will still be on the books. Then actually Keldon Johnson's expires that same year. So whether he's still on the Spurs or not is, of course, an open question. But there are these twin things, and I love that you brought up the Magic, because the Magic and the Thunder are the preeminent ones for me right now. Really talented young teams that also don't have much of a history of aggressively spending. The Thunder have paid the tax ever. The Orlando Magic have not, as far as I recall. And
I think they did the Dwight Howard years.
Oh, they may have.
Yeah, and so, but it wasn't like exorbitant amounts,
sure,
or anything.
And so what those franchises, they need to have this vision, Weltman and Presti in these cases, and convincing ownership of like, okay, this is how we're going to do it. And also having some sort of pressure release in case closer to that time, things don't work out. Because you kind of have to have that. I think that if I were running it, if I were owning a team or running a team, I would demand that of the people within the organization. And so for Orlando, yes, they have spending power in 24. They could roll that over pretty cleanly to 25, even though Jalen Suggs is going to get a raise and Franz Wagner will get a raise that year. But you have to do all of that with the knowledge and expectation that over the years of 25 and 26, those two plus Paolo will be getting their money. And so you have some wiggle room there, and we do expect the cap to increase significantly. But they have less than you think, and with OKC, that's the Chet Holmgren, Jalen Williams part of this, and they have a lot of other guys that could eventually do it as well. So they have spending power, and also it's important to note, this is the one, like a my tap the sign, is that the luxury tax is not calculated until the end of a season rather than the beginning. Yep. But it is also really true that you see the small dodges late, you almost never see the big dodges late. It has happened ever. But in part, and the thing that's going to run against that in the current vintage is the salary floor. So there are going to be fewer teams that walk into the season with a lot of flexibility. And so it will be harder to get that. And I think that we've already seen the kind of the early movers advantage for dumping space. I mean, I think about the Joe Harris trade all the time, where like Brooklyn did not have to give up much. Now, Detroit expected more from Joe Harris than they got still. Sure. And so it, those sorts of circumstances will still happen. And it's all, that is a bigger ask of ownership than we almost ever see. If they like, oh, I'll get below, trust me. Like that sort of a circumstance. But there are situations where, and these could come up with, I'd say it's more likely Orlando than OKC, considering how good the Thunder are already, where you know, like summer of 24 or summer of 25, the team has been good. They've been encouraging, but they haven't reached that conference finals level yet. And that the 1 to 2 years between when you make that commitment to the non-Paolo Franz Suggs player and that eventual potential bill coming home to roost, that's about 18 months, 19 months. And so there could be a circumstance, and I, if I were running a team, I would try to get this if I could, where you say like, okay, we hope and expect this is going to work out, but here is how we could avoid those worst consequences if you don't think at that time that will be worth it.
Yeah, I I think that's a kind of a really fun thought exercise, especially with like the Magic, because the Magic are not going to be in a position where it is, well, we'll just spend our way out of it. We'll just keep flipping. We're like, even though the NBA has these, I don't necessarily call them like barriers. I more call them guardrails, I think is a better way to put it, because there's like no end. You could continue to get insanely expensive. But I think what they have done with some of these teams where it is, even though they put those guardrails in there, you can still have a Steve Ballmer who's like, hey, just take on more until we can't, right? Even if it is, like I said, we're artificially pushing some salaries up to numbers that are they're not really where we believe, for example, Norman Powell should be, but we'll trade him later if we need to, and those kind of things. They can afford to do that. That's not where like the Magic are going to be. So it becomes really imperative. You may have one or maybe two chances at really getting this right, and you have to get it right, because otherwise we all know how it goes. Is all of a sudden then the next thing is Paolo starts looking around and saying, is it going to happen here? Like, well, where are we at? And then that turns it, you're really messy. And I have faith they'll get it right. It's just my one worry with Orlando specifically, a little lesser with OKC, because I think they've shown more than enough this year. They could still be the number one seed in the conference.
Yes.
So, but with Orlando is, there's I fear them coming back and saying, you know what, we were close, but it's we're just not there. Let's do one more year of kind of we'll run it back. We'll sign, you know, maybe a veteran or two. We'll extend Gary Harris. We'll pick up Joe Ingles' team option, and we'll just kind of run it back. And I feel like it's. No, there's not one player to definitely say go get that guy right now that they have to go get that's definitely going to lift them into the top half of the conference. But you can't be patient forever. At some point, you have to, even if it's risky, you have to take the risk. I'm with that. I wanted to go back something you had mentioned with the Spurs and Wembanyama, just because more just out of the fact that I think it's a very interesting conversation that was posed to me just today, earlier today when I was doing a radio hit. This is somebody who they get it, but they don't necessarily follow it. And he asked me, is Victor Wembanyama the first player that I can confidently say will make over $1 billion in salary alone? And I thought about it for a minute, and then I was like, yeah, probably. Like, which is incredible to think about. So then I actually sat down and said, well, what could it look like? And again, we're projecting more than a few years out here, but assuming everything goes the way we think it's going to go and he gets designated player in 30%, his extension right now, very loosely, because we're too far out, but projects to be 5 years, $326.5 million. So we're approaching $500 million on that one contract for him off his first extension, which is to me then that 100% locks in. He'll make $1 billion in salary, barring something completely horrible happening, which is just absolutely bonkers to think about.
It's a great framing. And so I worked it out. And so if a player had a 15-year career, they would need to have an average salary of $66.7 million during that time. But remember that you're artificially limited by the rookie scale, which will increase with the salary cap. So a 15-year career is actually closer to 20, you know, that would be a much longer career. But if Wembanyama, if he can get the Rose Rule max for that first year, he'll be on the road more quickly than most. It could even be somebody before him, just because of the timing.
Yeah.
But it is going to be, I mean, again, the numbers are, the sticker shock is going to be remarkable for people. At some point, I may have to rebuild my converter again, which I did for the for the cap spike in 2016, where it was like, well, here's what this money would have been as a proportion of the cap in 2012 or something like that. But it is going to be really beneficial for the league and for the players, of course, because they get a significant portion of that cut. And I'm going to keep an eye. This is more of just like a pin to float out there. And I brought up Memphis as this team previously, where there will be some teams that get saved by this structure, where it looks, and incidentally, the one that I harped on for years and wrote one of the angriest pieces I've ever written in my career for the Sporting News, that would have been this, is the Oklahoma City Thunder, which, so one of the ostensible reasons that they didn't agree to retain James Harden was that they were worried about an eventual luxury tax bill that never would have come, because the way that the money came in was there, and they would have known actually by the time that Harden's extension kicked in that it was going to be okay, but that didn't happen. There are a lot of what-if games with the Oklahoma City Thunder, that when teams are that good, you always have that. But like Memphis, for example, they're going to have Ja, Bane, and Jaren. And I brought up the year early idea. And so Ja and Bane being on their contracts, that the calculation starts, unlike Jason Tatum, before the 25 season, that's going to be a lot easier to make it work. And so we don't know where Jaren Jackson's things going, much less where the Grizzlies as an overall franchise. So there will be some that benefit from that timing, just as there will be others, potentially the Celtics because of Tatum, that kind of group. So you could, one way of thinking about this is the guys that are starting their second contracts in 24-25, like Tyrese Maxey, versus the guys who start it in 25-26, like Şengün, like Cade Cunningham, like Scottie Barnes. There may end up being a little bit, I mean, they're good problems to have, because anybody who's at that level, you're who's maybe 30% max, like, you're pretty happy about it. And I mean, so even, for example, the Pacers, I mean, I'm sure they're thrilled if Haliburton gets all NBA and is good enough for that and they can do everything else like that. But even his 30% max, should that be the point? Like, if the cap goes up as much as it looks like it might for other years, like, that's a pretty big difference too. So, like, I brought this up at one point. This is just one of my favorite stats with this, with how I have things projected. The 25% max, so that would be the, like, low-end rookie scale, in 26-27 is the exact same, almost, it's within a couple hundred thousand dollars, as my estimate for the 30% max this coming summer.
Yeah.
And so the idea is, like, this stuff is going to, like, it's going to progress even 10% a year, because we've never seen it where it looks like it's going to be pretty rigid like that. 10% of a big number is still a really big number. And so there will be times, and 10% is more than the 8% that salaries can go up contractually, other than an extension or something else like that. So there will be franchises that benefit from their timing, from that structure, and there will of course be others that are hurt by it. And I'm very interested to see how certain teams navigate that. And that's actually one of the big differences potentially for Philly between 25 and 24, or Orlando for that matter.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think, like, with Memphis, I look at them. I look at Minnesota. I spend more time looking at the Timberwolves cap sheet and just wondering.
You and me both, brother.
Like, what is going to happen here? And that's even before this week's news of, hey, we wanted to slash the payroll down to whatever, which my opinion is, I think we've got some white knight going on there of, hey, look, I saved the day here and this team we all love right now and those kind of things. But I also wonder how motivated teams are going to be if the second apron rules do curb the Warriors, Clippers, what the Nets were going to be, the Suns, maybe Celtics. If it does curb the spending of what those teams were trending towards, where it's going to be like, hey, we're approaching $500 million in roster plus tax penalties that are out there spending, those kind of things. If that curbs a little bit, I do wonder if we're going to see more teams say, all right, you know what? We want $1 million into the tax. We missed out on the tax distribution. It's not the end of the world, because it's not like we missed out on 20 million. We missed out on less because it's there and it was the right thing to do. We won more games and we actually, and that's, you know, that's for your front office to work with your actual team accountants of, well, we made more money because we had home playoff games and, you know, and all that comes out on your balance
sheet. Or see, you had increased season ticket sales or correct. All that type of stuff.
Yeah, exactly. We sold more merchandise, whatever it may be, right? We actually did okay. But I do look at teams like Memphis and Minnesota, who have little to no history of paying the tax. Like, both of them have paid such negligible amounts of tax that it doesn't even really matter. And neither one has had that, oh my gosh, here we are, we're here as a title contender. Minnesota is ostensibly having that right now. I think Memphis very easily could vault right back to that next year. But when I look at those teams, I'm like, something will have to give here, because they're not Boston, LA, Golden State. If the Knicks ever start spending like that, they're just not. And nothing tells me that that's where they're going to go. So then it becomes the game of, well, who is it going to be? You know, where do we go, you know, with this? And that's what makes it interesting. I also, as an aside, I know you probably know this, but just in case you don't, but it's fun for the listeners. Do you know how many guys have played in a game for Memphis this year?
Oh, it's 35, I believe.
I think it's 33.
Okay.
Now, I think Jack White was the 33rd player. They also had the other night, and this is probably going to be how the season finishes out, they had only 8 players play in a game. 6 of those players had been on a 10-day contract at some point that season. One was Gigi Jackson, who had been most of the year on a 2-way. And then the only player who had spent the entire year on the standard contract that played was Brandon Clark, who had missed almost the entire season.
Yeah. I believe Memphis has also had more than 50 or more starting lineups this year, which is jaw-dropping.
Yeah, something like that. Yeah, yeah, it's insane. And the fact that, I mean, I'm not going to say raise a banner for winning, you know, the amount of games that they've won, which is, you know, but winning 27 games under those circumstances, it's actually kind of impressive.
It is.
Like, you could have easily been the Pistons and, you know, barely, you know, at 13 wins for Detroit. Like, they could have very easily fallen to there. Like, it really is incredible. And this is why I am personally hoping they don't get all ridiculous and rash and say, well, you know, Taylor Jenkins fell off and the team fell to here. We got to make some change. Like, you got to give him a chance next year, like, with the real roster. At least that's my hope.
I agree with that. And I mean, another point on that is that Memphis, despite everything, they're still 13th in defense for the year.
Yeah.
And that is incredible. With the fourth unluckiest opponent of three-point shooting this year, when you consider just percentage, not percentage plus times volume or anything like that. Like, opponents are shooting 38.4% on threes with them. Median is about 37 this year. And so you could help a couple of points there. And when you think about, not only did they not have their best deep personnel for a lot of the year, like, They didn't even have what we considered a center for them most of the year, with Adams getting hurt and then traded, Clark getting hurt. And so there's, you know, a lot of Jaren and Aldama and various different other configurations. They did have Biombo for a stretch. So, yeah.
Your 6th through 9th guys in the rotation are 2-way guys, 10-day guys, and guys who joined the roster 2 days before and probably don't even know, you know, what your play calls are. Like, really remarkable. Like, it blows my mind that this is where we're at. And I was talking about this with John Hollinger a little bit one time, where I was like, you got not to this level. I'm like, what happens in Memphis? Why are they like team hardship exception? Because they had that, I believe
the Suicide Squad season. Yeah.
Like, yeah. And that one of those years they were a playoff team. And I remember having to do like a very quick deep dive into, are hardship guys eligible for the playoffs? What happens here? I don't understand, you know, this, because how are we here going into the playoffs with this team? But yeah, just bonkers.
Yeah. So last question I want to ask you is non-CBA. We could have done, I mean, part of the reason I didn't do a lot of playoff stuff with you, I mean, first of all, we had a great conversation, didn't need to, is we don't, other than Clippers Mavs, we know basically nothing, and the season ends in a couple of days. But what the question I want to ask you is the same one I asked Ben Golliver at the end of our pod last week, which is, you get sole right to pick any playoff series to make it happen. You can even pick the round if you want, but you don't have to. What series do you want to see most?
My instinct gut is I want to see Celtics Nuggets in the finals. I'm not going to pick that because I think we're going to get it. I want to see Dallas and Denver.
Ooh.
Because I want to see, can the Mavs do enough defensively to keep them in it with the Nuggets for a full series? Because I truly believe Dallas, other than maybe Denver, Luka walks on the floor in any playoff series and says, I'm the best player on the floor. I think he'd still believe it even with the Nuggets, because I think that's just his self-belief. But I also think, just as importantly, I think Kyrie walks right up beside him and says, yeah, and I'm the second best guy out here, so let's go. I think that would be such a fun tactical series of How does who does Denver guard Luka with? You know, where do you go with this? Because if you're going to put a big on him, then how are you going to cover up on the other side? You know, if you go with somebody else, who guards Kyrie? You know, what do you do? And then on the flip side, obviously, Dallas is probably just going to throw big after double, triples at Jokic and just hope they can figure it out. Like, I just think that would be such a fun series.
Super duper fun series. One of the ones that I would most like to see, and hopefully we get it this year or next. And Dallas being in the 4-5 definitely makes that a possibility. That it, and Denver looking like they firmed up the number one seed with their win on Wednesday over the Wolves. Not 100%, but getting closer to that.
Really close.
So that's one. I mean, what I picked with Ben, and I'm still going to stand by, especially with what's happened over the last week, is Bucks Sixers. I mean, just the sheer carnage of what that would be, both from a basketball tactical perspective, but also the narrative thing. I said specifically because it would be so much more fraught that it being in the second round would be really fun, because then one of those two teams makes the conference finals and everything else. But that at any point, and it could be as soon, and the most likely way that it would happen would actually be as a round one series, though it absolutely still could be a round two in like three different ways.
Yeah, it is. I was running through this over on Front Office Show, and I was saying, I don't remember a season, certainly not since we've expanded to the play-in tournament, where so little was decided with two or three games left. Like, it feels like normally by this point, we've got, of the 20 teams that make the postseason, 10 or more are locked into, I'll say, like a one seed range, because it might be they're locked into their seed or they're 4 or 5. And we know literally what Boston, I think, is still right now. We know the Bulls and Hawks are going to play each other. We know the Clippers and Mavs, but we don't know who's hosting those games. Like, it is just nuts that this is where we are this late in the year, which is awesome.
And Keith, not only is it that, like, we're doing that, there are 4 days left in the season, and one of those days has no games on it.
No games. Yeah, exactly.
So it's just like, and there isn't, like, I mean, we're recording this right about as games are starting on Thursday. There isn't even that much that's going to resolve on Thursday. Like, we'll get a little bit more color. And then there's also the detail. Nate and I were doing this. I keep a thing called the schedule book that Dunktown Prime subscribers can get. I've done it for almost a decade now. And, like, there's also the nuance this year where there are teams, I mean, the most extreme with this is the New Orleans Pelicans, where not only do the New Orleans Pelicans have three games left, all three of those games are against teams in their same conversation. So they play, because they play Sac, the Warriors, and the Lakers in those remaining games. And so there's just so much that could happen. And my favorite thing about it is that for now, and this will change on Sunday almost definitely, is that there can't be any jockeying, because you don't know whether the 2 seed or the 3 seed is better. You can't know. And so there is a circumstance. This is part of why I've argued picking your opponents and all these other things, that, like, you want people to push for the top anyway. Like, it just creates better incentives. But it's the next best thing, where you can't know. You can't game the system. And I'm especially thankful that the Clippers can't, because they're the team that has been the most egregious with this in the recent past. And now so that
Portland is bad.
Yeah, exactly.
Portland, if I remember, it backfired on them once,
I believe. But then it helped them the year they made the conference finals, where they ended up that year they ended up being on the side of the three. I think that was the year where you could argue that the three best teams in the West were all on the same side. And then Portland makes it to the conference finals. They're like, hey, we're good again. That happens too.
Were you? Or were you?
Feldman and I had a long conversation if people were interested in that on Real GM about 2 weeks ago.
I'm gonna have to check that out. Yeah, I cannot wait for Sunday, because I still think there's gonna be a ton up in the air Sunday. And I love that the NBA has gone to this. Hey, basically all the East teams play in the early afternoon game, morning game for you West Coasters, and then all of the West teams play in the late afternoon or afternoon game for there. And I think what's so fun about that is, I do wonder if it is, oh wow, Team X raced out to a huge lead. All right, let's take our foot off the gas, because we're not going to catch them. We're not going to do this. And I think there's just so much fun that could come into that final day, where I mean we may still have teams, you know, I've heard them talking about it today on a show. We could get to that day and it could be you lost and you dropped three spots in the standings, which is absolutely awesome to get to this point.
For and an it's gonna 82 game strength. Season, this isn't, you know, like the World Cup group stage, which is one of the ultimates in all this, where like things are shifting by the moment. That's, you know, three games typically. It's going to change with the new format. We'll see with all that. But
yeah, I said I need the live Premier League standings where it is just constantly updating. It's really hard in basketball because if a team's like going back and forth
for example, Wolves Thunder is now down to the fourth order tiebreaker.
Exactly.
Running some of those live are pretty complicated.
Crazy, but it's going to be a great
day. I'm so excited.
The one thing I just my minor nitpick on all of it is these are usually where I'm like, these are the last few nights I can get to bed at a reasonable hour here in the East Coast. And it's like, nope, got to stay up. Big game tonight. Going to stay up and watch it. So, but on the flip side, it's good training. I'm already ready. I guess I'm sleep training myself here as a fully grown man into you got to be able to stay up late to watch the playoffs when they come.
And I do really like that Sunday is early like that. It's that because that kind of sets the up. And I mean, you practically need that because of the play in and everything else. Yeah. So
it gives us time for like guys like us to then digest things a little bit, look at it, get a sense of, all right, where it is it? And as we start to break down the couple of matchups, we'll know, as well as the play-in tournament, which I still look at it and I'm like, we're going to have the Western Conference play-in tournament. It's just like the star power that's going to be in there is just it's must watch TV because it's like somebody's going home right now. And this is the closest thing we're getting to like NCAA tournament in the NBA is this like that's going to be awesome.
We are getting at least two massive talents that are going to be in the play-in and not in the playoffs in the West. We don't know who it's going to be, but it's going to be somebody. Like, that's just the way, like, we're going to, the league is going to lose marquee players during that. And that is unfortunate in some ways. Ben Golver did a nice little talk about that and like the downsides of that for the league, but it also is going to generate a lot of interest and it creates real stakes. And the other element this year that's going to be really, really fascinating is because of some of the other things that have shaken out. Now, Dallas is playing really well, so this isn't as true in the West as it is in the East, where the 7 and 8 might be more dangerous than the 5 and the 6.
Yeah.
So how does all that work? How does everything fit together? But you can't, like, I mean, I don't think we're going to see the Bucks lose on purpose to try to get down there in that line, especially because they're on a lot of these, as you brought up, there's no floor. So the idea of like, you could make your chances a little bit better. But then, like, I mean, they play Orlando in the last game of the year. Like, you can't guarantee that you're going to hit the 3. You might fall to 5, and then you're on the same side of the bracket as the Celtics, and you're in an even worse position than you would have been in.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, and then we don't have quite as much fun with the normally the other side of this is, all right, where are we at with pre-lottery draft positions? Because that kind of settled itself here over the last little bit. I know that's like one of your favorite things.
Oh, yeah.
With that, but yeah, I was kind of hoping we were going to be Raptors were right on the border, right of, you know, win or loss,
or,
you know,
or the Jazz falling below the Nets and a few other teams made that less interesting too.
Yeah, and it's now, who knows, we never know what the lottery will bring us, right? But it does get kind of, you know, fun with those things there of, you know, where do we go and all that. But yeah, it's this has been a, for my money, one of the more highly entertaining regular seasons, just from the standpoint of there are times in the NBA where it feels like, and I probably shouldn't say this to someone who relies on people caring about it year round, it feels like some of it doesn't matter. But this year it really has felt like, at least since the All-Star break, like this all really matters. Like these games have been important all the way through the stretch run here. And it's not always that way.
And this year gives some credence to the idea of like the runs matter earlier too, where you have that weird little stretch where you lose 4 out of 6 to mediocre teams and you're like, whatever. And then all of a sudden you're the 7th seed instead of the 3. And you like, or the Suns, like you're in the play-in potentially.
Yeah.
And then you have
Philly,
to deal with.
Like Philly is better positioned because they did lay waste to all those teams earlier. They could still get out of the play-in tournament, where if they hadn't been rolling through teams before Embiid got hurt, they'd be, you know, potentially facing, could they have been down around the 8 or the 9-10 game.
Yeah.
There. So yeah, it really is like, yeah, you gotta, it's added a layer of importance where I think the play-in tournament has changed so much with the league as far as creating all these new races and all this different nuance beyond just the idea of, well, it helped curb tanking. It certainly did. I don't think we have teams coming in now saying we got to be bad. That and the flattened lottery odds. You don't need to lose every game from day one. But yeah, it's been awesome. I am so excited for these last three nights. And I'm kind of excited for like Saturday to be able to like breathe and then jump right back in on Sunday into what it, you know, is hopefully going to be a crazy day full of madness.
Should be a lot of fun. Thank you so much for taking the time.
I appreciate it. Thank you for having me.
Thanks again to Keith Smith for taking the time to come on. You can read his work at SpotTrack. You can listen to him on the Front Office Show. And you can follow him on social media if you don't already. And, of course, mentioning again that Jared Weiss was on before. You can check out his work as well. Really love having both of them on and getting their perspectives and parts of it that, as you could tell, were connected, but also, of course, very much separate, too. And as I talked about a little bit with Keith, it's so strange to be this close to the playoffs, and I'm actually recording this outro after Thursday's games and still have so little clarity on the matchups and everything else. We'll, of course, get into that on Real GM Radio very soon. And if you want to support this show, there are a lot of different ways you can do it. You can subscribe, download every episode in the podcast player of your choosing. If we are not in a podcast player that you would like Real GM Radio in, please let me know, and I will pass that on to people who can actually solve that problem. You can also help other people find the show through leaving a rating or review, through word of mouth, through social media, all of which is appreciated. But the single most important thing you can do for this podcast and any other that has them is to check out our sponsors, Factor Meals, factormeals.com/realgm50, REALGM50, and use the code REALGM50 to get a 50% discount on your first box and 20% off your second, which is pretty fantastic. REALGM50 is the code. And Prize Picks. So you download the Prize Picks app, you use the code CLNS, so it's different for these two sponsors, and that gets you a first deposit match up to $100, which is fantastic. Also, of course, tells them that you came from us, which is much appreciated for us. You can also check out my other work, written work at The Athletic. I alluded to a piece with Keith that will be coming out relatively shortly, hopefully. It's in editorial on the free agent class. I have another one in the works. I don't know the timing on that because my stuff is less time sensitive, so it goes in a different process. And then, of course, Dunked On Prime, going strong. We recently did awards. We do some of our forward-looking stuff like Crystal Ball right around now. And then, of course, the playoffs are coming on quickly. And while, unfortunately, because there aren't League Pass games for very much longer, Nate and my broadcast on League Pass are done for this year. We are going to be back on Playback, and that is going to start on Sunday, and it will be, the current plan is to do the end of the Eastern Conference games, and then to do potentially the beginning or wherever we want to go in the West. Sunday could be a lot of fun. I'm really hoping that it will be, so you can check that out there. And if you have any feedback, good, bad, or indifferent, DannyLaRueMBA@gmail.com is the way to get it to me. If you take the time to write it, I will take the time to read it. That is an absolute promise. I'm not the greatest at replying, but I do read everything that comes in, and things do, and I appreciate that. And that is all for now. So thank you so much for listening. Take care and make it a great day.